Steve Chiotakis, and this is Greater LA, KCRW's show that connects you to the people and the places of Southern California. It's time to pick up the kids. We're at a daycare in North Hills in the San Fernando Valley. It's on a quiet, tree-lined street tucked behind a busy main road. The daycare is in a large, stately-looking house with a horseshoe driveway, so parents can pull in, pick up, and drive on out.
Come on, bye-bye. Bye, love.
It's 4 p.m. Parents are done working. Families going home to dinner.
Jacob, come on, Dad. Ready to go home?
Have a sippy cup today.
Thank you, ladies.
Bye.
But at this daycare, run by Peggy Nairn, kids are also getting dropped off.
There's still probably real close to about 50 to 60 kids here.
While most families are winding down around now, these families are just getting going. These parents work the night shift. They're the people making the offices clean and serving at all-night restaurants, staffing the urgent care. The city wouldn't function without them. Some of these workers have kids. Most people have someone at home to watch those kids, a partner perhaps, a parent. But what if you don't? Well, this daycare is open around the clock, and there aren't too many like it. Reporter Deepa Fernandez takes us inside to a little nocturnal world where small children bed down while mom or dad or even great-grandma go off to work.
Damien, Genevieve, I'm leaving.
Daycare drop-offs.
Give me a kiss.
Especially when you're two or three can be hard.
Pinky promise coming back, all right? Always coming back. Bye. Bye, God bless you both.
It's about 4 p.m. Raquel Antiveros is dropping off her great-grandchildren. Damien is five, Genevieve is three. They're in her foster care. She works the night shift as a janitor for Kaiser downtown. She'll be back in the middle of the night.
Before, she used to cry every day. Now, she's doing fine.
Penny and Peggy Nairn's 24-hour childcare and early education center is basically two big houses full of toys and games and puzzles and paints and cots for sleepy kids. Here, about 250 kids get cared for on any given day and night. Drop-offs and pickups happen constantly.
You need 4:30 a.m. Sunday morning.
So they call me. It's a janitorial service. So I'm cleaning up the Dodger Stadium. It's like 5 in the morning to maybe 1.
Okay, let's finish your food, sweetie. Your broccoli.
It's dinner time at Peggy's.
How about your oranges? You haven't finished.
Blanca Sanchez is dropping off her three kids.
I'm a server at IHOP.
And they go to sleep here?
Yes, they do. Yeah.
And then you wake them up at like 1 in the morning when you come?
When I get here, yes. They hate that part, but that's my schedule.
Back inside, it's frenetic. It's 7 p.m., that hour for toddlers when they fight sleep and want to keep going. Genevieve is one of the first to get ready for bed. She's the one whose great-grandma is right now cleaning the Kaiser facility downtown. She's tired.
And I'm putting my pajamas on. Yeah. I want to do it by myself.
Then there's this cute little firecracker.
Jayshawn, you're running too much. Miss Becky doesn't want you to get back up.
Jayshawn has been nonstop all afternoon, and now he's leading a band of little boys running circles around the snack table.
You need to get ready for your pajamas.
And finally, most kids have found their little cot on the floor and crawled in, snuggled under blankets. A movie plays softly on the TV above them. As the under fives are snuggling down, some already passed out, Jayshawn's mama comes in to pick him up.
Okay, I had a lot of patience.
Congratulations.
Thank you, I appreciate it. Right.
Jayshawn's fallen fast asleep. She has to carry him out.
Bye-bye.
Daytime staff is also leaving.
Have a good sleep.
The night carers bye-bye. Can take it from here. Tonight, just Miss Becky.
I'll bring you a blanket.
8 p.m. In the bigger kid room next door, a hive of activity. There's an art table, board games, and a little gaggle of girls is playing make-believe with dolls.
Hey, sister! Hey, sister! Can I pretend it's Christmas? It's Christmas!
You ready?
Yeah.
8:30 p.m., more pickups.
This has definitely been like a family to me because I don't have family here. So I don't have anyone to watch her when I have gigs. So this has definitely helped help my life, for sure.
Busy painting a box and sticking on crinkled paper that looks like grass is 8-year-old Alicia. Her mom is the IHOP server who works the late shift.
So do you go to sleep soon?
Yes, at 9:30.
And what's it like to have to wake up at 1:30?
Lazy. My mom wakes me up and it's so annoying.
Put your head on the pillow because it's almost time to go to sleep.
Back in the next room, the little ones are mostly asleep. Damien is not.
You're the only one awake.
It's almost 10 p.m. Genevieve was fast asleep, but now she's awake and sniffling.
Miss Becky's going to take your temperature, okay?
She doesn't have a fever, but she's clutching her ear. She won't settle.
Maybe I'm going to just call her mom.
Okay. It's okay. It's okay, mija.
Raquel, it's Becky from the childcare. You know, Genevieve had fallen asleep, and then she woke back up crying. Nana's going to call me back. They're going to call your uncle to see if he's at home. Okay? Okay, why don't you lie down on your bed, and I think they're going to come pick you up. Okay?
The sleepy pickup start.
King, Daddy's here. King. King, Daddy's here. Come on.
He ends up heaving him onto his shoulder, and they slide out the door. Half an hour later, Genevieve's able to go home.
We're going to go home, okay? We're going to get some medicine. You want some medicine? Yeah? Okay. Now get your brother.
And then there's quiet. 10:30 p.m. It's now just Miss Becky, the night carer, and a room of 8 sleeping children.
Each night, it actually varies on how many kids I have at this time, okay? Somebody's coming now.
Hi.
Hi, Becky.
How are you?
My sales were very slow today. No more no good tips tonight. Mama, wake up.
Waking her girls up is a challenge.
Hey, Mama.
Oh my gosh, they're fast asleep in the back seat.
That's what they always. But there's no other choice, right?
Do you ever think that this kind of a schedule might, like, do you ever worry about them, like, having to maybe not getting enough sleep or that?
They're used to it, honestly. We've been doing this for the last 4 years, I think. He used to hate it at the beginning. So they do have a hard time, but they can fall back to sleep right away. It is hard, but that's why I'm going to school. Hopefully I can find a different type of job.
11 p.m., back inside. This is all you hear. Meanwhile.
So, Peggy, it has just gone midnight, and you are still here. Sitting in your office. You've been here since 9 o'clock this morning.
Yep. Things have to get done. Paperwork that have deadlines. Department of Children and Family Services that funds for us. Child Care Resource Center that funds for the families as well.
Many low-wage night shift workers who don't have someone at home to watch their kids rely on the social safety net to cover the cost of nighttime childcare to keep their kids safe instead of leaving them at home alone. Peggy's center is one place that accepts families whose income is too low to pay market rate, so they receive a subsidy from the government.
How many of the kids that you have here would be subsidized like that?
Out of about the 250, about 214 of those children are subsidized. So that's quite a few children, families that need services that without those programs wouldn't be able to get the care that they need.
Back in the main room, the children are fast asleep. Miss Becky settles into an armchair. Now a few hours of nothing, except still drop-offs. Like one little 3-year-old who I find snuggled in Miss Becky's armchair in the early morning.
So she just got dropped off, so what time was that?
4:45 a.m.
5 a.m.
Quiet before the storm. No. We're prepared. Everything's sheets have been changed, ready for the next shift. And
So kids coming in now-ish will go and lie down?
Yeah, they'll want to lay down. They're tired.
I mean, it does make me wonder a little bit, is this good for kids?
I think as the kids grow up, they see their parents making commitment to work or to school, no matter what they're doing. And they're able to provide for the kids. And as the kids grow up, I think they kind of learn to respect what the parents are doing.
Good morning.
At 5:03, the morning influx begins. Jay Sean, the non-stop toddler from last night, he's back. His mum carried him out the same way, asleep. Then she got a call to come in early and do another shift as a nurse's aide at a major hospital where she loves working.
Have a great day.
Thank you, ladies. I'm glad you're happy.
6 a.m. breakfast. Scrambled eggs, toast, fruit. Soon, dozens of kids will arrive and eat and then get taken to school.
Kiara. Wakey, 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 Kiara. It's time to wake up.
A new teacher is putting away beds and coaxing very sleepy children awake.
Hi, Jay Sean.
And by 7 a.m., a dozen toddlers are raring to go.
By myself.
By yourself.
More are coming.
That story was reported by Deepa Fernandez, an early childhood reporting fellow at Pacific Oaks College, which is funded in part by First 5 LA. When those kids are a little older and maybe thinking about college, they'll perhaps face the dreaded SAT. But statistics have shown that kids from wealthy families generally score much higher on standardized tests than kids from poorer families. And as a result, quite a few colleges have stopped requiring the tests at all. Well, the College Board, that's the company that created the SAT, is trying to do something to address that bias in its test. And it's been trying out something it calls the Environmental Context Dashboard. Yeah, it's a mouthful. So it is becoming known as the Adversity Index. And what it does is it places a student's SAT score in the context of that student's environment. Without using any personal information, it generates this index from data about the student's high school and the neighborhood and number of students eligible for free or reduced lunch, the number of students that go on to college, the number of single-parent households, and the neighborhood crime rate. You get the idea. The College Board says it's been testing that new scoring system with 50 colleges. It'll be rolling it out to others this year and next. And with recent revelations of wealthy families paying to get their kids into prestigious programs and ongoing fights over affirmative action, college applications have become a pretty touchy subject. And the new SAT scoring system has received mixed reviews. But what about local high school students? What do they think about the idea? Reporter Jackson Cantrell talked to a few of them in areas with incomes low and high, all across greater L.A.
Honestly, it's just like, man, like, for some kids, it's a struggle, you know? They don't have, like, tutors. They don't have all the things, all the resources that other students would have had, you know? So it's sort of like an advantage that the other students would have had, while compared to, like, I'd say myself or other students here at San Fernando High, like, it's difficult for us because we don't, damn, I wish I had this or I wish I had that. Like, one more one-on-one time with the teacher individually.
Well, I mean, like, my family is not well-educated. They didn't even finish grade school, and they're actually immigrants from Guatemala, so... Like, school is school. Once I get home, the schooling environment is over. It's just like a home environment. Versus those people who have, like, their educated family, they already know, like, the system. They know how, like, things like that work. So, like, they do have a higher chance of opportunity.
I mean, I think it's pretty smart because, obviously, like, we have the, like, resources to buy, like, SAT tutors and, like, all the prep books. And, like, our school's obviously better because... But
I don't know if adversity score is what we want from the SAT. That's not what its purpose is. Colleges can figure that out for themselves. I feel like they know what schools we go to. They have their rankings and they have our home addresses. They can figure that out. So like I just feel like putting that into the SAT doesn't make sense.
People of that wealth, they get like the help they need. They get like
guided through like a good path versus us. We basically have to like, we're thrown out there and it's like, it's our own fight. That's like what my parents say too. Like, it's your own fight. Like it's, so we've had our struggles.
Really, the idea here, I think, is just to abolish the SAT because I really hate studying for it. And I think it's, I don't think it's a fair proportionate value of testing someone's intelligence, and that's it.
My parents, they were like, they only got a high school education, and I don't think they understand like the process of like SAT and all that stuff, because they studied abroad in like the Philippines, and I don't really think they understand like, oh, it's like a struggle. Education right now is like super difficult, and you know, like
some of the immigrant families, even though they might be like poor and stuff, they're really like focused on their children's education, so they'll basically have an advantage over the other people, I guess. So I think the College Board should like focus on like improving their free materials so that it's like better than the things you have to pay for.
There's a lot of families here who come from old money, and I understand that parents make sacrifices, and like I could say that the same about my parents too. I feel like a lot of times it's really hard for people from low income brackets to like to get out of that bracket, and so if it's impossible for them to have the same resources. But my one concern about this adversity test would just be, I'm not sure how College Board is gonna like adjust for the score, because especially because College Board is already pretty like not transparent. So like the way they adjust for the score could be I don't know, just like not a very good way to do it, and the fact that no one can know what they're doing can make it even worse.
I just think standardized testing is just dumb. Like, it doesn't, because some people are just bad at testing, you know? Like, I don't think it measures your ability.
That's reporter Jackson Cantrell speaking to high school students at San Fernando High, La Cañada High, and Troy High in Fullerton. Coming up on the show, chewing on the latest vegan and veggie options all across the Southland. We're off to Eat Street. That's next on Greater LA.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Back with Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiatakis. 2019 is the year of the vegan. At least that's what The Economist magazine has declared. It claims that a quarter of American millennials identify as vegan or vegetarian. And not surprisingly, Los Angeles is riding the wave with a batch of new restaurants catering to the growing interest in a plant-based lifestyle. Mona Holmes writes for Eater LA, and she joins me right now. Hi, Mona.
Hi, Steve.
Welcome back to Greater LA. What is LA's history with vegan and vegetarian restaurants? I mean, this isn't new for the region.
Not even remotely, Steve.
No.
There are what I call three waves of restaurants. The first wave are restaurants, vegan or vegetarian restaurants, that have been around for a long time. Some of them are still standing. For example, Real Food Daily, that's been around since 1993, first started operating in Santa Monica, that are doing, have been, and are still doing innovative things around vegan food.
Know it very well, yeah.
Orion Express, which is this wonderful little spot in Pasadena in the middle of fast food restaurant row, just across the street from Roscoe's Chicken and Waffles, where since the late 80s, they've been doing a completely vegan fast food menu that actually has a drive-thru. And then there's Simply Wholesome, which is in View Park next to Englewood. And they, even though they're not a fully vegetarian restaurant, they have a large section of their menu that's vegetarian and vegan friendly, and has been since it's opened in the late 80s.
And that was the first wave. What's the second wave?
Places like Cafe Gratitude, that's an absolute mainstay, and I believe they have four locations in Los Angeles right now. They started in Northern California in the mid-2000s. And at the bottom of their plate, they have a message for most diners that says, I am grateful or I am bountiful. That's kind of their style.
Yeah.
And then there's Crossroads, which completely changed the game, in my opinion, when they opened in about 2012. And they are set on Melrose Avenue. And their chef, Tal Ronan, he is an incredible figure in the vegetarian and vegan community. When you walk in, it just doesn't feel like a vegan restaurant. It feels like a very hip Los Angeles place in the middle of West Hollywood with an incredible wine list and cocktails. And you will go in there and see people like Ellen DeGeneres or Anthony Anderson from Black-ish who are just enjoying vegan food in a vegan restaurant, but they would never say so. They're just going out to eat. Then there's all these restaurants that are making their menus vegetarian or vegan friendly, that if you're like myself, like an omnivore who has a vegetarian husband, we can both go out and he cannot be relegated to ordering everything from the side dish menu and feel
like
he
the
gets,
mushroom burger
or
right?
the mushroom burger. Oh my God, he's the worst. He's a vegetarian that doesn't eat mushrooms. Yeah, I know, it's brutal. But then there's these places like Tony's Darts Away, where he can go in and get one of these impossible burgers that's double stacked with crispy onions and vegan cheese, and I can go and get my own burger.
You mentioned the impossible burger because we're hearing a lot about it, that they can't even keep up with demand. There is so much out there. Burger King wants to sell an impossible Whopper. But you also say, you know, that's sort of the lazy way to become vegan or vegetarian, right? That you're substituting something that you really like for something that may taste just like it but is not meat.
Well, I don't want to be too hard on people, Steve, but it's
I've had phony meat burgers, mm-hmm. and I think some of them are quite good.
I completely agree. Yeah. In fact, if you go into my refrigerator right now, we've got at least four, maybe even six impossible burgers because they're impossible to find if you decide to go out and try and buy them on your own. Burger King is jumping on the train. You can actually go in and ask Fatburger for an impossible patty if you like. It's great in this way because the impossible meat burgers and the sausages are a great way for people who haven't made it into trying vegan or vegetarian food, and it actually tastes good.
Southern California is sort of a trend-setting kind of place. How important has this region been, do you think, to the vegan and the vegetarian movement?
California has something that most states do not. We have the highest output of produce. And because we have easy access to these vegetables, fruits, nuts, and seeds, it makes sense that the vegetarian or vegan movement would be here. It's easier to experiment when your spinach is grown 60 miles that way and that you know your farmers. But I also do believe that Californians are more open to new things, no matter whether it's meat-based or not.
The last question I have for you is, what's your favorite? Do you have a favorite here in Southern California?
That's really hard to say.
I have a feeling I know what it is, but go ahead and tell me.
There's a couple. There's two in Inglewood, and one's called Stuff I Eat that's been there for over a decade.
Yeah.
And then there's another one called Ecolequa Cuban Cafe. Completely vegan Cuban, which I know, mind-blowing, right?
Right.
But you can't really dismiss the restaurants by immigrants that happen to naturally lean towards vegan or vegetarian, so Thai, Indian, Ethiopian. And I venture all the way out to Artesia for a restaurant called Surti Farsan, and they've been around since 1986. But if I'm driving up Western, I'll stop at Monty's Good Burger, Nick Adler's restaurant, or head to York Boulevard in Highland Park, where there's a ton of street vendors that have been popping up over the last year, and the majority of them are completely vegan. And then there's even a vegan brewery, a beer garden, down the street on York Boulevard, where every single item in that menu, from the schnitzel to the sausages, are completely meat-free.
Now, you did surprise me. Mona Holmes, reporter for Eater LA. She covers the dining, bar, and food industry throughout Southern California, regular here at Greater LA. Mona, thanks.
Thank you, Steve.
I'd like to take a moment to thank you for your continued support of KCRW, by the way. Thanks to you, we raise the money necessary to bring you quality programs such as Greater LA and Press Play and All Things Considered and DNA with Francis Anderton, which, by the way, is next. So thank you, thank you, thank you. I am lucky to be part of a great organization, great people who lend us your ears every day. So thank you for your support. Also lucky to work with Catherine Barnes, Sonia Geis, Reg Warna, Phil Richards, and Christian Bordahl. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Let's do it again tomorrow.